This is Booth 46, live from Pederino's. Not just in the heart of the Loop, but the heart of the Loop. Surrounded by theater, culture, and Chicago's movers and shakers. Each episode brings you, as Irv Kupcinet used to say,
the lively art of conversation.
Local vibes, real conversations, and fresh ideas for experiencing the city. So pull up a chair, lean in, and let's dive into the stories that shape Chicago.
Here we are again, another Booth 46 podcast!
Yay!
And we are live from Pederino's Restaurants. And this will be, as they say, a very special podcast, truly. In part because of the name, or a name, you may not know, but a really important one, one of the two guests, Mr. Al Friedman. Without his direct intervention, get this, in the River North neighborhood, which many of us enjoy, we almost take for granted in Chicago, even extending beyond that, actually, into the downtown area, it would not be anything like it is today without Mr. Al Friedman. From his development of small businesses, to major hotels, to residences, and also restaurants as a part of the Good Plate Hospitality Group, which includes Pederino's, where we are right now. And when it comes to architecture, Mr. Friedman is also responsible for much of the celebrated architectural preservation we not only have in River North, but throughout Chicago. Al Friedman is an unsung Chicago hero. Don't believe me? Ask Mayor Daley, Rahm Emanuel, Lori Lightfoot, and Brandon Johnson. They all know this guy. They respect this guy, and for good reason. And it was his idea to focus this podcast on what we're about to do, and that is celebrate and talk about the Illinois Holocaust Museum and Education Center. Mr. Friedman, thank you again for joining us.
My pleasure, and thank you for being here and sharing this with us.
Okay, here's my problem. Let me give it a try. Bernard Cherkasov.
You got this. You got this right.
Here's what I do know. The CEO of the Illinois Holocaust Museum and Education Center, which has been up in Skokie and has been up in Skokie now for quite some time, is now being relocated to 360 North State Street in the River North neighborhood, or really in downtown Chicago. So I'm curious, why did you move downtown? And please, I hope you tell us that you're going to stay downtown.
So our main museum in Skokie, which has been around for 16 years, is temporarily closed for renovation. In the past few years, our attendance has grown up, has grown dramatically. Just in those 2 years, we've beat our single-day visitation records 5 times. I think what you're seeing is, in a moment when the world feels in crisis, people look to history to learn lessons and to understand a sense of agency and a sense of optimism and resilience. And people have been coming to our museum. But at the same time, we've been bursting at the seams. So we decided that instead of painfully and slowly making the renovations, we're going to close the museum temporarily and make all the improvements that we need and reopen to the public. It also gave us an opportunity to come to the River North neighborhood, which is the heart of Chicago that, you know, all the tourists rave about and want to visit, and bring our, you know, world-class exhibitions there. And so we've opened the satellite for a year, and we'll see how it goes. But so far, it's been a great experience.
I'm totally not surprised. I mean, after all, right next to Marina City. But Mr. Friedman, I believe you think being downtown for the Illinois Holocaust Museum and Education Center is a good idea.
Well, part of it is because when we think of culture and history in our city, we oftentimes think only of the classics, like the Art Institute, and that's wonderful, or our theater district. But in fact, it's much more than that. It becomes something that we have to think about our past and what the past reflects upon our future. And nothing is more significant than we talk about the lessons we learned from this Holocaust. And bringing it downtown to where we have the visitors coming to our city is so much more significant than one would otherwise expect. So I'm feeling very encouraged that not only will they keep their museum and facility in Skokie for education purposes, but they'll keep their exhibit and their history here in downtown Chicago, so it will expose more people to this.
Yeah, I mean, when tourists come to Chicago, and that's not to mention all the people that live downtown that may not have a car.
Right.
Or anywhere near downtown that may not have a car, getting up to Skokie can be a challenge, and they might not even know what a Skokie is. I mean, if you're really, if you're from, I don't know, if you're from somewhere from France. By the way, I'd like to go to France anytime. But if you're from France, you may not know what Skokie. But on the other hand, Skokie is really well known, and there is a reason why. And I will say, I grew up in Skokie, so I'm very familiar with that part of the history that I'm asking you right now to tell me about as to why the location of the museum is in Skokie.
So, Steve, before I tell you about Skokie, I'll tell you that I, like you, dream of going to France. But the next best thing to going to France is going to La Grande Boucherie in River North, because there you can have a great glass of champagne or French wine and some French bites.
Now we're talking. It's also one of our restaurants. Attaboy.
I, you know, when I wanted a little escape, you know, stopping at La Grande Boucherie does the trick. So the reason
and
our...
I agree.
Yeah?
In fact, that's a lot less expensive than going to France.
And you still get all the, you know, the culinary and alcoholic delights. The reason that our main museum is in Skokie is because in 1978, the Nazis threatened to march in Skokie, which at that time had one of the largest concentrations of Holocaust survivors in the world, and had one of the largest Jewish populations concentrations in America. 50% of Skokie at that time was Jewish, and every sixth resident of Skokie was a survivor of the Holocaust. And what the survivors and their families realized is that the lessons of the Holocaust, which weren't at that time even too distant of history, clearly were not as well spread. And so instead of being angry, they decided to organize and rally and educate. So at first they built a smaller educational institution on Main Street. And then when that became so popular and resonant with the community, they decided to build an even bigger museum, which is now our for permanent museum in Skokie. And I'm going to tell you, in the 16 years we've been open, we've grown to become the world's third largest Holocaust museum.
What are the other two?
The one in Washington, D.C. and the one in Jerusalem.
Bernard, what brought you to the Holocaust Museum in the first place? And by the way, your background is just incredible. WGN Radio was once a supporter, and I'm sure still is, of Cradles for Crayons.
Yes.
Crayons,
yeah.
For example. And all of the things you've done legislatively. So I suppose I'm asking two questions in one. Before I hear what brought you to the museum, tell me a little about you.
So I'm going to tell you, my story begins when I was 13 years old, and my family and I fled anti-Semitism in our native Azerbaijan. And at that time, the ethnic tensions, you know, in that land were growing, not just verbal, they became more violent. And we had fled by train. We didn't know where ultimately we would end up, but we just had to keep going. And the train that took us out of Azerbaijan was, you know, pelted with rocks on which we were leaving. To this day, my mom has scars on her arms. Wow. From shards of glass and boiling water that were part of our journey leaving Azerbaijan.
You had to leave again, just to be clear.
Yeah.
Because
There were ethnic tensions, and including violent anti-Semitism at the time. Some of the violence was directed at other minority groups, like Armenians as well. You know, it was an area that was rife with conflict between different ethnic groups in late 1980s. And we, from Azerbaijan, went to Russia, then to Austria, then to Italy. It took us months to cover those journey before we came to the United States. But what I remember most about that journey is that at every step of the way, there were complete strangers who knew, did not know us personally, but who went out of their way to show us kindness. There was a lady named Eva in Vienna who would spend her weeks collecting clothing for all these refugees. And on Tuesday mornings, she would open her home so that these refugees could have some warm clothing for the winter. In Italy, there was this baker in this village where we stayed who would give me, my brother, and my cousins fresh baked goods because she knew that we could never get those ourselves. And so it went. And when we first came to the United States, many months later, after a very long journey, other strangers filled our home with furniture, with clothing for my brother and me, with school supplies, with books, and all these essentials that we needed to grow and thrive. And the sense that our museum calls these people upstanders, people who do selfless acts of kindness.
What is the term for that?
Upstanders.
Upstanders.
It's people who see injustice in the world or see hardship in the world, and instead of being a bystander, they stand up. They're nice. Upstanders.
Yeah, you like that. That's a great expression.
I've not heard that before. Well, tell me what you did before you were at the museum, and then what brought you to the museum.
So I was inspired by these selfless acts that upstanders have done to help my life, my family's life, and being part of the Illinois Holocaust Museum now and previously running Cradles to Crayons in Chicago and Equalitas, Illinois, was my way of honoring those selfless acts that these upstanders have done to transform my life and my family's life, right? And so I just feel really grateful that I have a chance to do that.
You know, I took a walk this afternoon downtown, and I want you both to comment on what happened to me today. So I'm walking, and this guy in front of me drops a phone charger, out of his pocket. So I stop him and say, "You dropped the phone charger out of your pocket." And he said, "Okay." I mean, he did not speak English. And he looked like scared. And then he said, in Spanish, "I have my papers." Mm. And I said, no, because I understand enough Spanish to get by if I'm talking to a five-year-old, you know. So I said, no. I said, that's not what I'm looking for, et cetera. I said, look, you dropped your... But to me, the fact that in America, and I want you both to comment on this, that would be the case is, to me, really, really sad. And actually correlates with what this museum is all about.
No, without question, that's really, it speaks volumes. When you think about just the Holocaust and it's the tragedy associated with it, it's about educating the next generation who may not have this familiarity and also giving a broader perspective on what life should be like and not having stereotypes about particular races, creeds, religion. It isn't just about Judaism. It really is about opening your eyes to what the future of our society should be. It should be a welcoming, open society, not what's happened in the past. We don't want to repeat these mistakes. And so that's why I think it's a wonderful thing to have this museum and this exhibition downtown where it's more centrally located for tourists and people who come to our city to have this experience. So when you come here, it's not just about going to a matinee or going shopping on Michigan Avenue. This is one of the things you would do, and I think it's a great asset. And so I'm not going to let them go.
Well, hopefully they don't want to. I'm curious, Bernard, if you'll comment on that story, as unfortunately things have gone on in the past 5, 10, 15 years that are different but somehow the same.
It's true. And, you know, our survivors who built this museum were so clear-eyed that we share humanity as not just one group of people, but across the human race, and that the Holocaust happened because the world failed to learn lessons from human atrocities, from genocides that preceded it, and because the humanity continues to fail to learn lessons from the Holocaust, other atrocities have happened since then. And the takeaway from all of this is that we should never stand by while one group of people is dehumanized, because, you know, what seems unimaginable at first, if we stand by when a group of people is dehumanized, becomes imaginable. And once that's imaginable, then the acts of violence that follow become possible, right? And so if we take any lessons away, is that dehumanization of any group of people should never be acceptable.
Without question. You see, our country was founded upon the concept that we were welcoming people to this country, not excluding them. And all these other countries that we've had history with, in which we've had this type of genocide is something we don't want to repeat. And it's about educating people. It's about opening their eyes to it, getting rid of those stereotypes that they're carrying. And your experience you talked about is rather sad right now. And that's what this museum and this exhibition is really all about. It's about opening one's eyes to where we need to be and where we need to go forward, and particularly young people, to get them thinking in a different perspective.
Absolutely. And I want to talk about the technology that you have. But first, I want to talk about something far more important, and that would be where we're at right now. Pedrino's Restaurant celebrating 25 years. Now I'm going to say that again. Celebrating 25 years.
Yay.
And the restaurant business celebrating 25 days is a celebration for many restaurants. In the heart of Chicago. In fact, I call Pedrino's the heartbeat of Chicago. Weekly lunch specials including their mouth-watering Italian beef and soon-to-be famous? Seared yellowfin tuna sandwich with zuzu lemon aioli. You can hear jazz every Monday night starting at 6:30 p.m. or try Sunset Sips in the Loop 2 to 5 p.m. and again 8 p.m. to closing Monday through Friday. Heated patios are open and you can bring your dog, which I love. Enjoy catering from Pedrino's Pastoria offering and... added a lot of calories at that place. offering breakfast sandwiches to homemade pastas, visit pedrinos.com to place your order. And by the way, the question that I need to ask, and it's going to be a boring answer in this podcast, I'm drinking an old fashioned. Mr. Friedman, what do you have?
I did have an Arnold Palmer.
Where did it go? Arnold shot the Arnold Palmer away.
Anyway, I'm having a new fashion. So I do want to say one thing,
yes,
to you, which this restaurant represents. It's about never giving up. And that's what the museum is about, never giving up. And I think that's critical for all of us in life. When someone says something doesn't work, something can't happen, people aren't coming back downtown, people are giving up on our city, you never give up. You never give up. If you do, you've lost it. And I think we want to have a welcoming environment for all of us in our city. And we want to see the future of our city getting better all the time. And this Holocaust Museum is one part of it, and a critical part of it, both from an educational standpoint, but also from a contribution of having the ethnicity of bringing all kinds of diversity and welcoming to our city, which is what we're all about.
Is Mr. Friedman the president of your board? He could be.
He could be.
And certainly your PR director. Very, very well said. Now,
yes.
I want to say something more important.
Go right ahead.
It has to do with what we have in front of us.
Yes, sir.
Peppermint ice cream.
Now we're talking.
The best on the planet.
All right.
This can cure anything. I really believe that's true. So you have an exhibit where you talk to a hologram.
That's right.
I did it. And the hologram does answer questions somehow that people in the audience have.
Yeah.
I will say this hologram failed because asked the question that the hologram did not answer. I said,
I'm dying to know it.
I said, when are the Cubs going to win a World Series? explain what the hologram is.
Is there
really is a hologram.
Yes. Is there any seer in the world who can answer your burning question about
probably
next
not
World Series? Victor. So, unfortunately, as time goes on, there are fewer and fewer Holocaust survivors left with us. And yet, there
are. Do you have any idea how many there are and how old they would have to be? I'm not good enough in math to do this.
So, the Holocaust ended around 80 years ago now. So, if folks were children when the Holocaust ended, that they would be at least in their 80s now, and many are in their 90s. There are still, fortunately for us in the world, probably tens of thousands of survivors still, but the ones who are active, who are able to share their stories, there are very few of them. And sadly, fewer and fewer as months and seasons
sure
go by.
Sure.
So in order to preserve their lessons and their stories and their own voices for history, we partnered with USC Shoah Foundation and in association with them developed these interactive holograms where survivors sat for weeks on end answering thousands of questions. And the technology behind it is such that when you're asking the survivor's hologram a question, is able to search behind the scenes for the answer that matches the question and is giving that answer back to the questioner.
So someone sat in a room and answered, an interviewer asked question after question that likely might be asked by an audience. And that had to go on for hours.
Yes, so it went for weeks.
Yeah, yes. Really, yeah, yeah. And then we can ask the question. A host for, at the museum speaks into a little microphone and says, why are you living now in Canada or something? And the answer comes. It's really quite incredible. The tech. Have you seen this?
I have seen it. It's absolutely fabulous.
Yeah.
Without question. It's the future of where we're going. Yeah. And it's a great way to preserve that heritage of the people.
Yeah.
And you also have a virtual reality. So you put on these virtual reality helmets.
Yeah.
And it's surrounding you. And you get a feel for what it's like or what it might have been like to be in one of those concentration camps.
Yeah. Let me speak to holography first. The technology is amazing, right? To be able to have a conversation with somebody who may no longer be with us, right? And ask them the questions that you otherwise would not have been able to ask. But also, it enables especially young people to ask questions that otherwise they might have been too uncomfortable asking of a real person. So sometimes when I sit in on field trips and I hear young people ask questions of a survivor, they might say, what did it smell like when you were in a concentration camp? And then we have survivors, different survivors, and they tell their different stories.
What is the most often heard answer to that?
Well, you know, there are some, you know, you can imagine, but, you know, in very tight spaces where they didn't have adequate plumbing or ventilation, the smell was not pleasant, right? Or they might say, what was it like when you had to say goodbye to your mother, right? In a way that sometimes it would be hard to ask that of another person face to face, but when you know it's a holograph, you lose your inhibition and it's a little bit easier, right? And there are some powerful answers. And I want to tell you, not too long ago, one of the founders of our museum was Fritzi Fritschall of blessed memory. And I was with a visitor and we went to the hologram and we asked Fritzi a lot of questions. And the very last question that our visitor asked of Fritzi, she said, what do you want me to remember? And Fritzi, through her hologram, said that despite everything that I have lived through and everything I have witnessed, I do not live my life in fear or anger or shame. How powerful is that? Right? For someone who survived the Holocaust, who most of his family was murdered, who lived on breadcrumbs that other women in those barracks were able to save up for her, to say that she does not live her life in fear or anger or shame. I think that's a lesson that all of us could carry with us.
Without question, it's about never giving up.
Yes,
and looking forward.
Which is something you talk about.
Very, very moving.
Yeah.
All right, so I have some questions for all of you that we ask all of you.
Go right ahead.
Yeah, Mr. Friedman says, you can ask me anything.
Go right ahead.
One day I'll find out where that line is drawn. I'm going to go
I've got a hologram that's going to answer that.
All right, so what is, Mr. Friedman, the best job you've ever had? Not including talking to me.
Best job is interesting. Best job is being a father and being a grandfather. That's the best gift you can be given.
No. So if being a father...
And a husband, by the way, in case my wife isn't just so you know.
Does she listen to this?
She might.
Good answer. Yes.
If being a father counts as a job, then single-handedly the best job, the hands down, the best job I've ever had as well. I have a 16-year-old, and I cherish every moment as well.
Okay. I accept that answer. What's the worst job, Mr. Friedman, you've ever had?
You know what? I don't have any worse jobs. I appreciate every day of my life and everything I do, and I never give up. So
even
I don't
like
have.
When you were a kid?
I never had a worse job. Never.
Hot dog story?
Hot dog story. You want me to tell you hot dog stories?
Sure.
At age freshman,
great hot dog.
No,
story.
13 years old. My mom passed away when I was 11, and my dad and I lived together. And every day after school, I would take the L downtown to work at his hot dog stand. And he named it after me because I worked so hard. And then at age 14 and a half, I started driving a delivery truck for him.
And that wasn't the worst job.
No, it wasn't. I appreciated every day of it. It was an opportunity to meet.
How old were you when you were driving this truck?
Did you hear what I said?
Yeah.
They allowed back then.
What?
If you needed... If
it's amazing you're here.
I learned to drive a stick shift easily.
14.
Yes. Actually, it was 14 and a half. I said I was 15. But because if you had a hardship, they gave you a license early. Hey, let's not go down that path. I can only tell you, he was open 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. And going back to the people who came to this city, my grandparents had a pawn shop on Maxwell Street. And every Sunday, I worked on Maxwell Street. And I was selling playing cards. I'll get into it, but anyway, my dad was running a rooming house, and they played pinochle all the time. And the 8s, 9s, and 10s were taken out of the deck. And my dad and these people were professional gamblers because they were train conductors. And after they were done playing, they had all these stacks of cards. I said, "Hey, Dad, could I have those?" And he took them to a printer, and they shaved a 1/16 of an inch off them, and I boxed them. I took them to Maxwell Street, and I was now 14. Maybe it was 13 and a half. And I used to go down the street, quarter, drink of water, and I got a box. You'd buy the whole box of 10 for $2. I'd come home with $100 cash every Sunday.
Wow. I'm picturing it.
And by the way, I didn't consider that a hardship. Anyway, I got a lot of stories. We'll do another podcast on that. I can tell you how I got Medina Temple and how I became a potentate after I got it. But yeah, we'll discuss that another day.
I definitely want to hear that podcast.
Bernard, the worst job you've ever had.
So maybe not the worst, but the hardest. When I was 10 years old, and I would spend all my holidays and breaks from school in my grandmother's village. And I would have to go early in the morning, almost at sunrise, to the market and sell chickens. So I was a 10-year-old chicken seller, live chickens.
What did the chickens say about that?
Well,
okay, what makes you the happiest?
I'll tell you what, the happiest is watching what you create as a person in your life. And it's about seeing, it's about when someone says you can't do something and it won't work, showing them that it can happen. And no different than downtown Chicago. When it was at the end of the story, when State Street used to be the street, when Randolph Street had all of the movie theaters and everything, if we grew up here, and it was all dead and the crime was here, I said, I don't want to give up. When Rich Daley was mayor, we sat down, we went through each of these theaters. I never wanted to give up. When the Goodman Theater came along, and they said they wanted to build a theater here and they couldn't put it together without doing this corner and having a restaurant, I said, let's make it happen. I've never said no. I've never given up on anything in my life. So I'm always happy to see the product. But more importantly, I've got 1,500 people who work for me. And all those people and their families depend upon what we do. So that's my greatest reward, is what I've given back.
I love that. Okay, Bernard, what makes you the happiest?
So, you know, I have a 16-year-old Miriam, and when she gives me some time, whether we're going for a drive or just hanging out together, those are my happy moments. Sometimes they're few and far between, but I love each one of them.
Okay, what is the best thing about being here in Chicago?
I grew up here. I love the city. And when someone says something that isn't right about the city, I'm there to defend it and say, you don't understand the city. Come and stay here. And I've had many people who come to the city, and I take them out for a week, and they say, boy, this is really a great city. I don't want to listen to what the press says. I want people to experience what our city is truly like.
So actually, social media is saying something very different, but in a good way, sort of. Because of negative press, people have come to Chicago in big numbers, social media influencers who've never been here. And they get here, and they look up, they look around, and they say,
I think the energy that this city has, this is the city of innovation, of modernity, of, you know, there's so much creativity here for everyone. And I just love it.
Well, this podcast, I think, is about lessons learned more than anything else. Would you agree, Mr. Friedman?
Yes, without question. By the way, one of the great things about our city is our location. We're central in the United States. And when Ron was mayor, he and I went to Asia together, and he's told those companies there, why go to the West Coast? Why go to the East Coast? Come to the central United States. We have all these colleges, universities. People want to stay here, and it's all part of the process. And that's without question. So I enjoy, I appreciate it, and I never give up, and neither should any of you.
I think there's a book in you, and the title is Never Give Up, I've been thinking. Mr. Friedman, you know the admiration I had, and the same for you, Bernard. I mean, to find a way to celebrate, for lack of a better word at the moment, what we could learn and take advantage of what we potentially can learn so we don't repeat the past. Unfortunately, it's being repeated in too many ways, but your mission is to stop that from happening. And reaching young people in particular, thank you for that. Great conversation with two wonderful people. Thank you so much for having me.
That's a wrap from Booth 46 at Petorino's, where the loop comes to life. Thanks for joining us, and until next time, keep the conversation going and keep exploring Chicago.